Hello, everyone. I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate, and today I'm joined by Dr. Zach Whitman, an experienced reptile veterinarian. Zach, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
So, Zach, we usually like to start the podcast off by getting to know you a little bit, so you mind telling us a little bit about who you are, how you first got into reptiles, and what was your career path leading up to now?
Yeah, I can definitely start out with a little bit of the bio. I think, like so many of us, it started out really early for me. When I was a little kid, it was not reptiles in particular. It was all animals, it was dinosaurs, it was just anything and everything. When I was a toddler, I was obsessed with horses. When I was a little kid, my dad got me a little tropical fish tank set up in my room. So I had a little 10-gallon tank for a lot of my early childhood. As soon as I was old enough to be playing outside, I was catching bugs and whatever I could kind of get my hands on. And that progressed up to the reptiles and frogs real quick. I was always super interested in anything that I could actually touch and hold. Things like looking at birds through binoculars was never quite as exciting for me. I did have a pet bird when I was a kid, and my parents were always very tolerant of animals in the house, but they never wanted a dog. It was too much work. And they never wanted snakes because my mom didn't like snakes. And those are the two things that I was always like the most into, of course. I had this nature center behind my house. Like I grew up in very suburban New Jersey, like walking distance to Manhattan, like right near the George Washington Bridge, if that means anything to anyone. Not a natural, not a place where you'd find a lot of natural abundance, but my house happened to butt up to this little nature center, which had this little pond and some walking trails, you know, it's just a few acres. But there was box turtles there, and there was little snakes there, and there was frogs and turtles in the pond and stuff like that. And that was just where I spent a ton of time. And eventually I had a parrot for a little while, and a family member ended up being asthmatic and couldn't end up living with the bird and had to give it up. And my mom sort of said that I could get whatever else I wanted to replace the bird. And around the same time, I met a family friend who had a couple of big snakes. He had some boa constrictors, and I was like 8 or 9 years old, and I got to meet these boa constrictors. One of which was huge, like a really true, like 12, 13 foot Colombian. And meeting those snakes, and I got to watch one of them eat. This guy he lived in the city, and he would go to the live markets and just grab rabbits and chickens and stuff to feed them. And to me, that was just having like National Geographic, Discovery Channel in your living room kind of level of cool right there. And it took a while for me to work on my mom to let me get my first snake. But when I was, I think, 8 years old, I brought home my first king snake. We found a breeder in Brooklyn. So this would have been 1992. And there's this guy, I don't know his last name. I've always kind of wondered what happened to this guy. Fred, if you're out there, breeder from Brooklyn back in the day. But he had a collection of king snakes and corn snakes and some rat snakes, and they were kind of built into these wooden cubbies in the wall in his kitchen and his apartment. The whole thing was heated with like a string of Christmas lights wound through the back of it. It was this whole funny homemade setup. Anyway, I ended up with this little pencil-sized Cal King. And right around that time, I started getting Reptiles magazine, which was like the original. That was right when that magazine started coming out in the early 90s. Throughout middle school age, I kind of got a couple more reptile collections added to the bedroom kind of thing. My second snake actually was a ball python. I just thought they were cool. I was looking for something that was beautiful and small. I wanted a python, but I couldn't handle anything big. This was just before the morph thing had even started. I had some leopard geckos. That was the first thing I ever bred when I was a little kid. I was breeding leopard geckos. And then when it really kind of got more serious for me was when I was like 13, there was a exotics pet shop that opened up in town. This place called Jungle Exotics opened up in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And it was like a little reptile specialty shop that rented out a room at a fish wholesaler. And I started going there to get feeders and immediately got myself like a little high school job there. And I just spent all of my time at this shop. So that would have been mid to late 90s. And there was tons of cool stuff being imported still at that point from all over the world. There was a lot of morphs starting to show up, but there was still just a ton of diversity going on. There was a lot of captive breeding going on. There was a lot of information being shared. The kingsnake.com forums were kind of lighting up, and that was the first time that, you know, you could go online and connect with other breeders and share information, and that was a really cool kind of thing to grow up learning. Like while I was at the shop, that was kind of going on. And I think I had always wanted to be a veterinarian growing up. If you'd asked me when I was a little kid what I wanted to do, I probably would have told you I wanted to be a veterinarian. But working at the reptile shop and being right outside one of the biggest cities in the world and still not having really good access to reptile vet care, was really what kind of kept pushing me to focus on school and do better. So it was always on the back of my mind, but also always, you know, a little bit of a pipe dream. Obviously it's a super competitive thing to get into. But yeah, being at Jungle Exotics, being at that pet store, my boss there is a guy, Joe DeAngeli. He's an educator. He kind of gave me my start and everything. And we bred some stuff there at the shop. But mostly it was just your typical reptile pet shop. Yeah, so that was kind of how it all got started out early for me. In terms of school and that kind of pathway, I ended up going to University of Vermont, up in Burlington, where I was an animal science major. And when I got there, one of the first things that they did was all the animal science students went to this lecture hall, and the dean of the animal science department was like, you know, how many of you are here because you want to go to vet school? And probably like half the room raised their hand, like 60 people maybe. And she was like, all right, well, statistically two of you are going. So if any of you have anything that you would rather do, now is a good time to think about that. And that was kind of day one. I was super cocky, you know, that didn't deter me at the least. I'm going to be one of those two. And then immediately just started having fun in college and slacking off and partying and not doing well enough in classes, the kind of well that you would need to do to get into vet school. And it was only like two semesters in where my advisor pulled me in and he's like, so you're thinking about vet school? And I was like, yeah, maybe. And he's like, well, let me just show you what your GPA would look like if you got nothing but straight A's from here on out. And that number was already kind of like borderline of what was possible to get into vet school. So there was a good period in there where I just wasn't sure if I was going to continue down this path or not. I ended up taking some time off. I went abroad with my girlfriend, who I've been with, high school sweethearts, been through all of college, and now married and have a family together. We went to New Zealand together for a semester, and I came back and I transferred from going to school in Vermont and thinking about vet school. And I decided I was going to maybe do either genetics or marine biology. I was kind of going to give up on the whole vet school track. And I switched schools, started going to school at Northeastern, transferred. And I was really thinking about doing the marine biology thing. And I started volunteering at the New England Aquarium in Boston. And that's where I met Charlie Innes, who is one of the preeminent turtle veterinarians in the world. Charlie's an amazing resource. But what I was doing at the New England Aquarium was working in their rescue and rehabilitation department. So they do a ton of work with sea turtles there. They get cold stunned sea turtles that that migrate up the coast in the summertime, and then they get caught in Cape Cod Bay in the winter and wash up on shore freezing cold. So getting to be a part of that and seeing the role of the zookeepers and the educators and the people who were licensed wildlife rehabbers, and seeing the role of the veterinarians, it just kind of really reignited in me that was really what I wanted to do after all. And so I took the extra year to finish all the prereqs I would need to finish and get the kind of grades I would need to get to end up doing the vet school thing. And then from there, vet school is its own whole long pathway.
So you mentioned turtles was kind of what got you back into going to vet school. Do you currently work with turtles at all?
Yeah. I currently do a lot of wildlife rehabilitation with turtles. I founded my own not-for-profit wildlife rehab center. We treat a lot of sick and injured turtles. We incubate a lot of eggs. And probably my biggest accomplishment, and one of the things I'm most proud of, is the work that we're currently doing with Blandings turtles. We're head starting Blandings turtles on a project with the New York State DEC and the Wetlands Trust, and a couple of other partners. And it's just been a really amazing experience to get to participate in field research and an active kind of boots on the ground conservation effort for a rare local imperiled herp species.
And as a general rule, what role would you say vets play in conservation projects?
You know, it's a big subject. When it comes to reptiles, I would say vets don't play enough of a role. There are unfortunately a shortage of true reptile experts in the veterinary field. And that was something that has been changing over the course of my lifetime. And reptile veterinary care today is so much more widely available and so much more high quality now than it was when I was growing up. But especially when it comes to field research, there's still a lot of stuff that's a little bit of the wild, wild west, with field biologists doing whatever they want to and whatever they can without a lot of veterinary supervision sometimes. Thankfully, the DEC does take that kind of thing very seriously here in New York. And so when we're talking about a Head Start kind of program, there's a ton that goes into making sure that everything is really biosecure, that these animals are healthy, that we're raising them in a way that we're growing them rapidly, but not too rapidly. We're raising them in a way that they can go out and perform successfully in the wild. And definitely a lot of veterinary management involved in that side of things. We do a lot of the shell notching, the pit tagging, And just in the course of following a lot of these turtles with transmitters, we actually run into a lot of predator-induced damage and human-induced problems, even within our study population. So definitely plenty to do. Probably more from the reptile husbandry side of things, though, to be honest, than the veterinary side of things on the day-to-day when it comes to the Blandings project in particular.
Okay, and you mentioned that there's reptile veterinary care has been increasing both in quantity and quality over your lifetime, but still not where it needs to be. What would you say to people who might be interested in going into reptile veterinary care? What advice do you give them before they go to college?
Yeah. You know, I think that there's a lot of really good ways to work with animals. And I think that if you're really, truly passionate about being a vet, you know, you need to kind of have two honest conversations with yourself. One is, do you really know what it looks like? I think a lot of people have a little bit of a glorified idea of what a veterinarian's life really is like, and the salary and income to educational debt kind of ratio, and those kind of factors. And also just the reality of the competitiveness of getting in. The truth is that there is a line of people with perfect test scores and straight A's and years of experience, and only a very tiny percentage of them are getting in. And there's lots of people who are really strong applicants who would make great veterinarians who apply year after year after year and don't get in two and three times. And it's really devastating. So I always try and tell people to have a backup plan. And if there are other things that you could think of to do that would make you happy, do that. If you really truly think that this is something that you're really deeply passionate about, then just do everything it takes. Just fight for it. You know, keep applying, keep getting more experience, keep getting your grades up, do what you need to do. And eventually you're going to get it. I certainly did not have a perfect GPA, and I did not get into vet school the first time I applied. But you just gotta keep working for it. And even once you're in vet school, it's not going to be handed to you. I don't think it's possible to not be a reptile person and then go to vet school and come out of it being a good reptile vet or a good exotics vet. Just like I don't think you could, you know nothing about horses and go to vet school and learn everything you need to know about horses and come out and be a really good horse practitioner. So, you know, when I was at CSU, I went to Colorado State for veterinary school. There is a ton of additional stuff that you can do to study exotics. So on top of all the regular course load, I would take additional exotics courses, additional exotics wet labs. Anytime we had optional, you know, each year you would get 4 weeks or 8 weeks of rotation time to have elective rotations. And I would always do those at zoos and exotics animal hospitals and wildlife rehabs and things like that. Take every opportunity I could to volunteer. I would volunteer at the, there was a raptor center that I volunteered at there. You just got to take every opportunity you can to learn on your own. Nobody's gonna spoon feed the exotic stuff to you. You know, right now it's awesome that there actually are boarded reptile specialists out there. That was something that was just kind of happening when I was graduating from vet school, is they were starting to offer the reptile board exam for the first time. And so if you're in any of those areas, I think right now there's 15 boarded reptile veterinarians in the US. And you can definitely search for those guys online. But if you're in Seattle, if you're in Southern California, if you're in any of the major cities in Texas, if you're in Southern Florida, there's a lot of really, really high quality vet care that you could seek out in those areas if you go and find a boarded reptile vet who is not going to steer you wrong and is going to be an asset to you, whether you're a pet owner or a huge breeder. And there is also ARAV. I don't know if you're familiar with the Association of Reptile and Amphibian Veterinarians. It's a fantastic organization. It's very, very small though. You know, when you compare the membership and the size of the organization of like the boarded avian veterinarians, and the boarded zoo veterinarians and all these other specialties, all the cardiologists and neurologists and all these other things out there, you know, the size and scope of the reptile group is really, really, really small, really, really sorely underfunded, if you ask me. And that's something that I don't even feel like the reptile community knows very much about. That's something that I try and promote a lot when I go to reptile shows. I really try and educate people about ARAV, and I try and direct some of my philanthropic donations towards them. But that organization is the one that supports all of the veterinary education out there. They're the ones that write and produce and edit the Journal of Herpetological Medicine. They're the ones that host the conference that all of the reptile vets in the country go to every year to get together and, you know, enhance our knowledge. And so it's a really small little group that I really wish that the herp community would support better. I think if we support the reptile vet community, we're going to get better reptile vet care out of it for everyone. So there is a there's a search function on the ARAV website, like a find a vet kind of function. And if you go on there, you can absolutely find someone. If you're, you know, you really have to live in the middle of nowhere if you can't find someone that's on that ARAV list. And being on that ARAV list does not necessarily mean that you're a reptile expert. It means that you're someone who has an interest in exotics. It means that you're someone who wants to make yourself available to exotics. But I'm sure you're familiar with plenty of situations where veterinarians have led people astray or claimed they were an exotics doctor and not actually been as competent with reptiles as they were with other things. You know, those types of situations definitely exist. So you still have to do a little bit of homework and really, I think, especially for people with big collections, valuable collections, it's really valuable to just have a relationship with a knowledgeable herp vet if you can ahead of time.
Yeah. So switching subjects a little bit, the saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. As a reptile veterinarian, what are some of the most common maladies and health crises you see in private reptile collections, and what are some things that people can do in their own personal care to eliminate those maladies?
Yeah. I think that really looks different depending on kind of what population of the herp sector you're talking about. I think that you would hope that over time we would somehow overcome the ability to get people past the beginner mistakes. But the truth is that reptile keeping as a hobby continuously attracts new people who continuously make the same types of beginner mistakes. Even when there is lots of good information out there, there's still a lot of impulse buying. There's still a lot of just misunderstanding out there. People who read a care sheet and just don't quite see how what they're doing is a little bit different than what's being suggested. So the type of stuff that I would suggest for beginner reptile owners, pet reptile owners, people who have one bearded dragon in their living room and belong to a couple of Facebook groups kind of thing, those guys I think can really benefit from participating in knowledgeable online groups, local herp groups. I do really think that having a relationship with a veterinarian in that kind of situation is really helpful, because a good reptile vet will pick up on problems earlier than the owner will in terms of catching metabolic bone disease kind of problems before they start, checking animals for parasites before they get too skinny and before they get too run down for them. Those are not the same kind of problems that you see from experienced keepers and from breeders and those types of owners. For people with bigger collections, for more serious people where the husbandry issues are not really the main problem most of the time, the biggest thing that I wish I would see people do a better job of is quarantine. That's the simplest and best possible thing you can do to keep your collection safe. You're exactly right. Ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and that goes like 10,000 fold when it comes to quarantine. Keeping, you know, if you have a room full of valuable reptiles and you're just bringing new stuff in from a show, it's only a matter of time before something really terrible is going to happen. And I think that even just the simplest act of just keeping reptiles separate for at least 90 days and just keeping an eye on them is a huge thing in and of itself. It doesn't cost anything. Reptiles do everything slow. They get sick slow. They show you problems slowly. Minimum of a 90-day quarantine. And depending on what kind of species, you know, the details of quarantine is really species specific and collection specific. But, you know, things like getting fecals done, if you're talking about boa snakes, getting nidovirus testing done, testing for inclusion body disease. If you're talking about colubrids, maybe testing for crypto. You know, there's a lot of species specific recommendations you could make that I would recommend doing during those 90 days, or even ideally longer. I quarantine anything new coming into my house goes through a ridiculous quarantine process. I don't mess around with bringing things into my main collection. And the way I have my whole reptile building set up is like a fortress between the wild turtles that are coming in injured and the blandings, which are protected from everything, and the snake and exotic side of things, which is totally separate. You know, it's, I think that you get what you put into it when it comes to quarantine. Nothing is perfect. But the more careful you are, the less likely you are to run into major problems.
Yes, something I've been hearing more and more is just how important quarantine is. And it really is true that you really are taking a risk just bringing a brand new thing into your room every time you do that. So you mentioned you have your own little collection. What all do you keep?
I've done a lot of stuff over the years. So back when I was in, when did I first get my anthills? I got my first anthill pythons when I was in college. And I really got interested in these tiny little guys, and I really kind of was honing my husbandry on getting the babies started successfully. When I was in vet school in Colorado, I started my first reptile breeding business. It's called Slytherin Creations. And I was breeding a lot of locality colubrids. I had a bunch of locality calkings, locality corns, some red milk snakes, some black milk snakes. What else? I had some Cape gopher snakes. I had some Dumerils boas, and I had chameleons, pancake tortoises, a couple different species, little micro geckos, and I had the largest and most genetically diverse collection of anthill pythons in the country. I had all the major bloodlines represented. And then when I was 27 and in the senior year of vet school, I started getting sick with some really weird symptoms and ultimately got diagnosed with a really rare and aggressive form of lymphoma. So kind of had a major scare, had to suddenly pause vet school, move back across the country to New York to start getting all kinds of treatments. Ultimately, I had a bone marrow biopsy, and I was very lucky to walk away fully recovered now, 13 years out, or 12 years out. But I unfortunately had to get rid of almost the entire collection. I didn't want to leave my fiance at that time with, it was like a room full of 120 snakes. And so when I got my diagnosis, I was like immediately on a plane and back in New York right away. And a friend of mine who was she was a vet student also, but she was a couple of years younger, and she was into reptiles and just wanted to learn. She had been just helping out, watering snakes, doing that kind of thing with me. She kind of immediately just took over care of the collection, and I was just selling things online as quickly as I could, and she was just boxing stuff up and shipping it out. So I only kept a handful of things. There was just a couple of king snakes that were pets from childhood, and a couple of the pancake tortoises. But really got rid of a lot of really, really, really cool stuff that some of which I've never been able to quite track down again. I've been keeping my eye out for nice looking Cape gophers for 15 years, and haven't found what I lost. But it took a little while after recovering from the illness that I went through before I kind of had the confidence to start putting together a collection again, to start even thinking about breeding again. And when I finally did that, it was kind of like the peak of the ball python craze. And I remember way back in the day, even when I was really interested in colubrids, I remember seeing those first pictures of piebald ball pythons on Pete Cal's ads in Reptiles magazine, and being like, I'm gonna have one of those one day. Just I always loved the piebalds. I always thought ball pythons were cool long before all that.
Unpopular opinion about piebalds: I never really care for them. To me, when they're coiled up, the mixture of brown and white lumps just looks like something. It looks like something a bird would leave on a windshield.
You know, I totally get it. Ball pythons are not for everyone, and every morph.
I like ball pythons. I like ball pythons, and maybe it's just me being jaded at seeing them piebalds everywhere. That might just be the reason why, but still,
totally.
That's what I see.
I totally get that. For me, there was something kind of jaw-dropping about them. I'm also totally a genetics nerd. I was thinking about going into a career down that kind of research pathway road if I didn't go into vet med. So I've always just kind of been interested in the genetic side of it. But to be honest, the bigger reason why I got into it was I really wanted to, you know, before I got sick, I just kind of kept whatever I wanted to, whatever I liked, whatever I thought was cool. I just was breeding it and working with it. And I didn't care if it was cheap or, you know, I was breeding locality corns and selling them for $50. It was the colubrid market was like bottoming out, and that didn't bother me at all. But thinking about getting back into it and thinking about what life looks like when you're changing 100 water bowls, I wanted to do something a little bit more philanthropic, and I kind of wanted to almost use ball pythons to bring people from that community into more conservation content and colubrid content and just kind of other stuff. I think that the reptile community is really, unfortunately, very very subdivided. And there's so many people in this country who love reptiles and keep reptiles and know nothing about the endangered species of turtle that lives in their backyard and could totally benefit from help. And I think that when you talk to turtle conservation people or any conservation people, the herp trade is often viewed in a really, really negative light. And I don't think that that is necessarily accurate or helpful framing of anything. And so I just really kind of want to try and break down barriers as much as I can. So if you follow any of my social media, you're going to see a lot of pictures of cool looking ball pythons thrown in there with a lot of conservation content and a lot of rare species and political issues relating to herp keeping and those kind of things. So I try and be a bridge as much as I can.
Yeah, but you just mentioned Colubrid content, and that's actually how I first heard about you. Was I saw you give that talk at Colubrid Fest a few months back about egg binding, both prevention and causes prevention and potential treatment of it. You don't have to give the full 35-40 minute speech again, but do you want to go over the basics of egg binding again?
Yeah, for sure. I also realized I didn't even answer your last question fully in terms of what I actually keep, because I told you what I lost when I got sick. But I do have a ball python.
Sorry.
I have been putting together a really cool group of Asian rat snakes. Gotten a whole bunch of nice stuff from Matt Most recently. Have some more locality Cal Kings. I actually have my very original line of Cal King. It's the first snake I got when I was 8 years old. I bred that snake and gave my first baby I ever hatched to my girlfriend in high school, now my wife. And I still have the third generation from that snake. So I'm rebreeding breeding that guy this year and maybe giving one of those babies to my son. So I'm kind of trying to do that little lineage thing. And I still have a whole bunch of anthill pythons, still got the ball pythons, and breeding some Bayard's rat snakes this year. Those are going to be big enough to go for the first time. Working with Williams geckos, which is my newest project that I've been having a lot of fun with, and starting to produce a whole bunch of babies of those. What else? I think that might be it at the moment. Yeah, I think that's it. But yeah, in terms of egg binding, that's always been a really big kind of passion of mine, and just in terms of perfecting reptile husbandry in general. And I think that some of our husbandry practices around egg laying are just a little bit outdated and I think that making some small changes can go a long way towards preventing problems. And I think that when things go wrong, there are a whole host of things that people can do that are dangerous and a whole host of things that people can do that are helpful. So the shortest possible version of it, I would say, is that your females need to be in really ideal condition going into egg laying starting from the season before. And the year before is when they start to develop their ovaries and when they start to develop the circadian rhythm for when everything is going to happen. And they need good body condition, really good nutrient plane while they're building up those ovaries over the months and months before they're even thinking about reproducing. So got to start out with healthy animals. You got to have your husbandry nailed down before you're even thinking about breeding. And when it comes to colubrids in particular and egg laying in particular, the most important thing to know is just how secretive they are about it. They really don't want these eggs to be found. And
friends don't let friends use clear nesting boxes.
Yeah. The darker you can possibly make their nesting area and the tighter and the more humid and the closer you can get it to the temperature that the eggs should be at, all those things are really, really critical for success. And if you get those things right, you're going to see that your females are very, very quiet around nesting time. They're not going to be doing a lot of cage cruising. They're going to be in their nest box, and you're not going to run into problems anywhere near as often as you will if your snakes are stressed out and looking for a dark place to lay when they only have a clear nest box with a half inch of damp sphagnum in the bottom of it. So yeah, fill those nest boxes up to the top, spray paint them black, get some plastic ones, do some 3D printing. There's a whole bunch of creative ways to make really great nesting options depending on the species that you're working with. 5-gallon buckets are great for some species that are getting a little bit bigger. There's a whole lot of creative stuff that you can do to give snakes a really nice dark private place to lay eggs. And this is one of the things that I think every step along the way, you know, there's plenty of home remedies that you can try depending on your level of experience, and depending on the type of snake and how many eggs are stuck and whether they're stuck really high up or whether they're down close to the vent. There's a lot of stuff that you could do as a home remedy. But to be honest, every single thing that you could do at home would be better off being done by somebody with more experience, with the benefit of sedation, with the benefit of antibiotics, with the benefit of sterility and knowing their anatomy. So I definitely don't recommend that most people go palpating eggs out of snakes on their own at home. I think that should be a last resort when you've tried a couple of other things first. And I think that having a veterinarian before that situation develops is a really, really, really helpful thing. Once you have a situation where you have a snake that is egg bound and you're trying to find some emergency vet that you hope knows something about reptiles, and then you're taking her out of her environment and bringing her someplace new and stressing her out, I think the whole thing devolves rather quickly. I think if you have a relationship with a good exotics vet, ideally, if you have a big collection, if you're a breeder, if you can have any relationship with a traveling exotics vet, someone that can come to your facility, that's a huge, huge advantage. Because, you know, every state's have slightly different laws about prescribing in emergency kind of situations. But usually in most states, if you've examined an animal or been to a collection within the past year, you don't have to see those animals necessarily in the moment to give medical advice and, you know, do things like give oxytocin injections or calcium injections or fluids or things like that, where your vet might be able to kind of direct you to do some of those things at home or come get medications and bring them home without bringing the snake in, those types of things, where if you have those relationships set ahead of time, you have a good resource to reach out to instead of scrambling around in an emergency situation.
All right. Now, besides turtles and snakes, what other reptiles have you done any veterinary work with?
On the veterinary side of things, I've done everything. I mean, I would say crocodilians probably are the least of what I've done. I've done some zoo work with some crocodilians. I have kept some alligators. But no, I would say that I don't have, you know, thankfully crocodilians are rare in captive collections in the Northeast because they shouldn't be in most captive collections in the Northeast. I don't have a ton of zoo experience with the big crocs. You know, the majority of my experience, has been with all of the more common pet trade stuff, from monitors to chameleons to geckos. I do, you know, all of my work here is with native aquatic turtles. So I would say, you know, I currently work at a veterinary emergency room. I treat anything that walks in the door, whether that's a deer that's been hit by a car to a bald eagle to a box turtle. I find other rehabbers to take most of those animals, and I only bring home the reptiles and the amphibians to my rehab. And I would say probably 90 to 95% of my rehab is freshwater turtles and box turtles. So snappers and painters make up the majority of it, but we do every year several wood turtles, quite a few box turtles, usually a couple spotted turtles. We do have bog turtles here in my area, which are very rare in New York, but thankfully have not had any of those come in injured or crushed through the rehab. Obviously we have the Blandings turtles, which we get some occasionally coming in through the rehab side of things. I have done a lot of tortoise work on the veterinary side of things, you know, through private practice, people bringing in tortoises, all of the common pet trade, you know, the big 12 species of the pet trade ones, your bearded dragons and leopard geckos and ball pythons and, crusties and all that kind of stuff. I've done some work with exotics, with hots, with venomous stuff, but not a ton. Some amphibian keeping. I've done some dart frog keeping. Pretty much crocodilians are my big gap.
Yeah. I was going to say, what experience do you need with Haas? I mean, all you do is pick a taipan up by the middle of the body and it can't do anything, right? That's a joke. Do not do that.
That was my introduction to how to handle Haas, actually, was to pull a Jeff, what was it? Jeff Leibowitz, Lebowski, whatever. I had been, you know, thankfully in the Northeast, venomous reptiles are very uncommon and very locally, you don't run into them all over the place. Growing up as a kid, trying to stick my hand in under every snake board, I was not worried that I was going to grab a rattlesnake most of the time in New Jersey. When I was chasing a black racer through some knee-high grass, and I really wanted to catch this snake, and I was standing right on top of it, and I see its tail poking out from under the grass, and I reach down and I grab that tail and I whip it up, and copperhead. That was the first venomous snake I ever caught.
I'm guessing you got lucky and didn't get bit.
No, I dropped that thing so fast, and since then I used to go back to that spot all the time to find copperheads. That was one of my favorite spots, but they tore up the whole area and put a pipeline through there.
Ah, damn. That's always a shame.
Yep. Yep. Those are hard things to watch.
So, have there been any species that you haven't had the chance to work with that you really want to work with?
Oh, yeah, man. The bucket list is long. Yeah, yeah. The bucket list is long for sure. I love indigo snakes, and I have never kept them personally. I've worked with them a little bit in a couple different settings. But if I was going to keep indigos, I would want to do it big and do it right. And I just haven't quite had the setup and the resources that I want to do it, even though I have a whole building dedicated to my reptiles. I just haven't pulled the trigger on those guys yet. I've always really wanted to keep more monitors. And again, just the amount of, at the moment, I don't have anything in my collection that requires insects on the daily. I do feed fruit flies to the Williams geckos, but I do feed them some gecko diet also. But my life is just so busy between full-time job as an ER vet and trying to parent and run a household and do the breeding thing. There's just some high maintenance species that I just haven't been able to pull the trigger on, but monitors are really, really, really high on the list. Love, love, love tree monitors. And always really, really, really close to making that decision. I've always wanted to get into some more arboreals, both colubrids and boas. I have always wanted to get into emeralds and basins in particular. And I've always liked a lot of been attracted to like rhino rat snakes, red-tailed rat snakes, gonyosoma. I like a lot of the bright green, diurnal, kind of active moving stuff. So I think I might, those are things that I'm looking at next. But there's a lot of stuff, a lot of pythons, a lot of rare pythons I want to get into. Yeah. So many cool reptiles out there, man.
Yeah. All right, it's getting kind of late. Is there any closing statements you want to make?
You know, I would just encourage people to think about reptile conservation. If you're a reptile hobbyist, I think we've done such a good job at promoting US ARC. And I think that so many herpers out there and even kind of casual herp keepers out there know about US ARC now. And I want to see that same kind of mobilizing effort towards herp conservation and towards supporting herp vet med, and supporting field research. I think that, everyone would really benefit to, you know, if you're thinking about making a donation this holiday season, find a reptile organization that you support. Really small amounts of money go a long way towards organizations like the Association for Reptile and Amphibian Veterinarians, the Orion Society. You know, there's a lot of great small reptile conservation groups out there that need our support. So I would just encourage anyone who's listening to this podcast to go seek some of those organizations out and give them some support.
All right. And if people want to get in contact with you, how can they reach out to you?
Best way to contact me at the moment is probably through my Conservation Herpetoculture Facebook and Instagram, or my website. My rehab side of things, I do have a not-for-profit. It's called the Center for Reptile and Amphibian Conservation. But I have virtually no web presence for that at the moment, although that's likely to change. Stay tuned for that one. But yeah, through Conservation Herp. Anything else?
No, that's it. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been fun.